people, if they haven't already gotten informed already, lots of great useful links for people to check out that you'll find on my Gab.
Thank you so much, Carissa.
Well, thank you for having me on again. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.
WBAI is the radio station speaking truth to power, presenting a range of alternative views so you can keep your sanity, like Elvis Costello says as he walks through troubled times. What's so funny about this love and understanding? And for WBAI to continue, we must pay rent at 4 Times Square, which houses WBAI's transmitter.
We're 2 months behind on that rent, so it's $34,000. So that's a lot we have to catch up on. So a really good reason to support WBAI right now. So help the one truly listener-sponsored radio station pay for the rent to house our transmitter. Say, yes. This is a donation.
2 months behind, folks.
Yes.
What are you going to do when it's gone? Then right. You're going to have to listen to pancake recipes
Paulette.
By Brian Lehrer.
Yeah.
$17,000 a month is what it costs, and we are trying to raise enough funds to pay back rent from 2021 and the rent for 2022. Please go to towerfund.wbai.org, towerfund.wbai.org, and donate to keep listener-sponsored WBAI broadcasting into the future, or call 212-209-2950 and say you want to donate to WBAI's Tower Fund. Thank you.
Well, it is very clear that I have to reacclimate myself to this place. I was on 2 weeks ago with our annual Tolkien special, but there wasn't a whole lot that I had to do for that show. But I have hardly worked in the control room that we are in. And for me, it's sort of a, well, new experience. But I did an engineering shift, which would go from 6 a.m. until 4 p.m. And I then began to realize just how much work, how much trouble our engineers like Sean Rhodes and Max and all those good people go through. And I'm having issues even right now, just figuring out, okay, how do I get this thing that I've got queued up on the air? And I think I have discovered the secret.
Is the hour between night and dawn. It is the hour when most people die, when sleep is deepest, when nightmares are most real. It is the hour when the sleepless are haunted by their deepest fear, when ghosts and demons are most powerful. The hour of the wolf is also the hour when most children are born. Ingmar Bergman's Hour of the Wolf. The hour in which reality becomes a mockery of madness and masks hide behind faces. The hour of of all final moments, Hour of the Wolf. Max von Sydow, Liv Ullmann, in Ingmar Bergman's Hour of the Wolf, a diary of truths and lies like truths.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And this is, actually our first live, relatively free-form program in just a little shy of 2 years. But I can tell you that what you will be hearing are readings from Carlos Hernandez and C.S.E. Cooney from the most recent New York Review of Science Fiction readings. Stay tuned. And again, good morning. Well, what a long, strange trip it has been. Very few people have the access to come into the station and do their shows. Pardon me, that's my phone trying to tell me, you're signing in from a different computer. Yeah. Okay. So, sorry, my phone is telling me that it's an unhappy phone. And, we're playing with a different set of rules now. I don't know how long it will last. I will tell you that I've heard rumors about the availability of the space downstairs here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, where we hold the reading series that you're about to hear. Now, we've been doing it virtually since March 2020, but now we're doing it online. It's available on both Facebook and YouTube. If you go to Facebook to the NYRSF Readings group, or to YouTube, to my page, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, you can watch any of the readings from the last 2 years. And we actually take Q&A and do things like that. It takes three of us to operate it. And the rumor is that the downstairs area of this building is not going to be available for us to do, us being me, and other people who regularly rent the space out. We've had a staff member get married down there and all that good stuff. So we're going to see how that works out. But we do have for you this morning the latest reading from online. If you want to watch the people doing their reading, Carlos and Claire, they are a married couple. It is our habit over the last few years, hell. The series is in its 31st season. So for about the last 20 years, that we always have a married or enfianced couple do the reading. More often than not, Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner, who are a very long-term couple. And then all of a sudden they started spending their December holidays in Paris, which sort of made it difficult for them to show up live. And so we've been playing around a little bit here and there. One year we actually had a game show. That was a lot of fun that Catherine M. Valenti and partner put together for us. And Carlos Hernandez is a wonderful, wonderful writer who's been on this show live quite a few times, as has been Claire Cooney, who writes under the name CSE Cooney. And they are now properly married and all that good stuff. So they were last year and this year's wedded guests for the reading series. And first, we're going to hear Carlos Hernandez. When I first had him on this show, he was a guest of a guest. Delia Sherman brought him along so that he could read on one of her stints. And he was wonderful. I thoroughly love his short stories. But of late, he has begun novels. YA novels, young adult novels, of all things, being published by Disney. It's, I believe, a series of five. And they are Sal and Gabby. First one is Sal and Gabby Destroy the Internet. Second one, Sal and Gabby Destroy the Universe. And the third book, I think, actually should be out. He'll announce whether it is. Obviously, these are great holiday books for youngsters. I enjoyed reading them. I love reading YA books. But you know what? Before I was going to do that, I'll hold off the movie review. We do have a movie review from Dan Persons, but we're going to put it in a little later into the show. First, though, talking about my lack of prowess in this control room. Sean, if you happen to be listening, he is here doing his shift, which is a heck of a lot better than my being in this room doing his shift. If you happen to be listening, I can use your help for a wee bit of technology. I can always open the door is open. There's nobody around here but he and I. And just shout down the hall. I believe that's exactly what I'm about to do. Because I want to play something, you see? And it's a USB device. Hey, Sean, if you got a second, I could use your help. So, there we go. I don't know where on this console where they have put the darned USB input. I know where the output is to play something from USB, but over there in the actual computer?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Okay, this which one is one? Is that that's one and this is two?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. And we're on one. You can barely even see where the USB plugs go. There we are. Thank you, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, sorry about that. And yep, it's showing up as a device that I can play from. So what we're going to do, let me explain a little bit about the reading series. The reading series was started 31 years ago by Gordon Van Gelder, who at the time was with St. Martin's Press and or Tor Books, then moved along to buy the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, otherwise known as FNSF. And he has since moved on, and he's now simply the owner and publisher. And C.C. Finley is the fine editor. That's one of the better science fiction magazines. And he started this reading series. And from the very first one, he called me up and said, would you like to come in and record? That particular one was Thomas M. Dish and Samuel R. Delaney. And it's like, duh. You know, do I want to come in and record that? Yes, I do believe I do. And after a few years, he gave that up, and somebody else involved in the magazine came in and took over, and somebody else, somebody else, somebody else. And, oh, about 12 years ago, maybe even a little more, I took it over. Now, I had been recording them from day one, and there was nobody obvious. We had Cherie Renee Thomas, who is now the editor of FNSF, and I think a more important person in the field of science fiction than she gives herself credit for. And, pardon me, I'm looking for, now that Sean showed me where to plug in the USB drive, I have to figure out, I have to tell you, I hate Windows 11 or Windows 10. I'm a Windows 7 guy, and I'm going to have to switch. I have a new computer at home that runs Windows 10, which will automatically, of course, update itself to 11, and I just don't like the interface. I just have to say that. I would sooner go Mac, and I'm not a big fan of Macintosh computers either. So now that I know where I've plugged the darn thing in, now I have to simply figure out where it comes up on the computer. I hope that you enjoy my rambling on like this. If you want to call up and ramble with me, oh, I don't even recall Linda Perry Barr. There, I've gone through all the variants on her name. Sent me the various phone numbers. The most important phone number that we're going to give you is one to pledge for, you heard a cart for it before a promo, for the tower, our broadcast tower, that almost killed the station when, without our input, our owners in California negotiated a contract with the Empire State Building. We eventually negotiated our way out of it. And now we are, I believe the address is Four Times Square. And it's, tens of thousands of dollars less, but it still has to be paid. We're about 2 months behind in rent, which is a lot better than being 3 years behind, which we were at one point. And we need you to help fund our back rent on that and our future rent to get us through 2022. We have almost lost the station October of 2 years ago. We came very close. We were certainly off the air for about a month as a result. And that had repercussions that I'm not going to get into the particulars of. But the thing is, we need your pledge. We need you to earmark a pledge to pay our transmitter rent so that we stay, you know, on a major frequency, as well as, of course, webcasting and all that. And that telephone number is the number you would usually use to dial up and talk to us, 212-209-2950, or set your web browser for Tower Find. That must be a typo. I'm sure it's towerfund.wbai.org. Towerfund.wbai.org, or just go to wbai.org, and where it says donate money, well, please do that, because we need it in order to continue. To call on the air during this time, it's 212-209-2877. And at some point during the show, I don't know if I'll be doing it just yet, but to do that, well, at some point, as I said, we'll be taking calls this morning, which is why I bothered to wake up. I could have pre-produced this on recording, and Sean Rhodes would have made sure that this goes on the air, as he has so kindly done since this current health crisis, which is coming right out of the pages of science fiction novels, are coming from. Let's see. So this is Win 11. If I click here, okay, there we go. That's almost like Windows 7. You can click on My Computer, and it shows you the available drives. It worked. Excellent. So, in the reading series, the way that we do it online is we use a private service that allows up to four of us, to be talking at the same time, but visually and orally, although occasionally the sound quality is not always great. But then we can actually simulcast the event, both video and audio, on YouTube and Facebook Live. And 'tis a good thing. Let's see, if that comes up over there, which pot will it be over here? It has to be this one. It has to be. So, during these times, my partner, Barbara Krasnoff, herself a Nebula-nominated finalist from a couple of years back, or Amy Goldschlager, who was a curator of the reading series before I took it over 13, 14, 15 years ago, or I will invite somebody, host the event, and do that. So this previous month, this very month, I should say, was Amy's turn. And here we have her, I trust and hope, introducing the wonderful Carlos Hernandez.
Hello, friends. It's Amy Goldschlager again, welcoming you to the December edition of the New York Review of Science Fiction Reading Series. Anyway, here we are in December, which is holiday season, and here at the Reading Series, that always means family time. And so we've got one of my very favorite creative couples, CSE Cooney and Carlos Hernandez, who are going to read to us from upcoming and works in progress, and it'll be a wonderful evening. Our first reader tonight is going to be Carlos Hernandez. He wrote the critically acclaimed short story collection, The Assimilated Cupid's Guide to Quantum Santeria, the novel Sal and Gabby Break the Universe, which won the 2020 Pura Belpre Award, and its sequel, Sal and Gabby Fix the Universe. And I'm sure we all know that there's a deal to bring Sal and Gabby to the screen, and I really, really hope that that happens. But in the meantime, option, free money, awesome. Carlos has also written dozens of short stories, poems, and works of drama, usually in the SFF mode. Most recently, oh gosh, I'm going to mispronounce this. Hernandez is one of the authors in the Rick, is it Riordan? I hope I've got it right this time.
Yeah!
Because the last reading I went to, there was a contest, and I think in my head it's always been Riordan, which I know is wrong. Rick Riordan presents anthology, The Cursed Carnival and Other Calamities. Or maybe it's The Cursed Carnival, because I always like that better. Yeah. Currently, he and his wife, author C.S.E. Cooney, are completing work on their GM-less role-playing game, Negocios Infernales, which will be published by Outland Entertainment. You can find Carlos on Twitter at write, that's W-R-I-T-E, teach play. Carlos Hernandez.
Hello, everybody.
And also Claire.
Oh, yeah. Claire is right there showing you our little, this is the backside of the card for our game, Negocios Infernales. It comes with a deck of cards. And I'll just mention quickly that tomorrow we have a charity event that we're running through Pat Ruffus's World Builders charity. We're running an infernal salon that's going to use those cards to inspire a whole bunch of writers. We have people like Martha Wells and, I mean, just like a ton of people to basically raise money for World Builders. So, you know, you're having fun tonight. You like this kind of show? Come tomorrow as well. Thank
you. We interrupt this broadcast for the latest bulletin. I just got a text from my partner that apparently the Hugo Awards for last year, which are normally given out in September, have been given out for this year. So in between our two readers, I will tell you who the nominees and who the winners were of the Hugo Awards awarded yesterday. And now, back to Carlos.
Thank you so much, New York Review of Science Fiction, one of the absolute institutions here at New York City in terms of science fiction. It is always such a pleasure to come and read, and I hope all of you will continue to support Amy and Jim and Barbara and the whole gang so that we can keep this reading series going. Tonight, I'm going to read you two things, one thing very short and one thing not so short. Both of them not yet published. One of them is almost published, though. So the first thing I'm going to read you is a short poem. It's called On the Mobius, and it's going to be published in On the Deadlands, which is a new magazine that came out just really, I think, like 6 months ago. It was just crowdfunded. Sonia Tafe is the poetry editor there. And I wrote a pantoum that's going to come out in the very next issue of it. And so it's very sort of like rhythmic. And if you don't know what a pantoum is, it's a highly, highly repetitious poem where the line, two of the lines from the previous stanza get teleported into the new stanza. I think it's lines 2 and 4 move into 1 and 3 and it loops around and stuff like that. They don't have to be quite as rhythmic as I've made this one, but it's rhythmic. So I hope you enjoy this poem on the Mobius. I won't resist. I know I can't. I'm statue still. I'm scentless. Take a whiff. There's nothing left of mind or fear or promises. I'm statue still, of scent bereft. I'm sea glass tumbled smooth by salt. I don't mind fear. It promises to come and go and go and come and go. I'm sea glass, yes, still new, still sharp. I hate my edge. I need more time to come and go and go and come and go on the Mobius, the dead and living ride. I hate my edge. There was a time I loved it, loved to kill and eat. But on the Mobius, the dead and living ride, I feast upon myself in time and love it. Love to kill and eat the molecules over which I ruled. I feast upon myself, for time has taken all my sovereignty. Well, those molecules over which I ruled, they severed all their bonds with me and all my former sovereignty. I wish that none of it remained. Sever all your bonds with me. I scream to nothing voicelessly. I wish that none of me remained. Wherefore this helpless qualia? I scream, and nothing voicelessly replies its voice, a cavern's hush. Wherefore this helpless qualia? An echo? No. The wish for one. I am become a cavern's hush. I won't resist. I know I can't. An echo of myself? I wish. Take a whiff. There's too much left. That's On the Mobius, everyone. Just to give us a little bit of a warm-up, to me, it's like one of the closest things to a song or song lyrics that I've written in a long time. So that's our little taste to get us warmed up today. Now, what I'm going to do, though, is read you something that has no promise of being published because I haven't sold it anywhere or anything, but it is, by intention anyway, my next novel. It's called Thig. That's T-H-I-G, Thig. And the reason it's called Thig is because rats are thigmophilic. I don't actually have the ability to write in the chat. So if I could, I would write thigmophilic in the chat so you could Google it quickly. But thigmophilia, it means that you are touch loving. And what that means in terms of rats, for instance, is that rats use their whole bodies to map their worlds. I mean, their eyesight, not so great. They do have good senses of smell, but that only get you so far. Really what they do is they map their worlds in 1,080 degrees, basically by rubbing up against it and getting used to the passageways and the turns. And this is another reason why rats, you know, they don't like to change their patterns. They're neophobic because once they get their map, they want to use the map that they have because that's a map that they can trust. So rats are thigmophilic. And what I did in my fantastical way of thinking about these things was think, all right, so rats already love to rub up against each other and around the world and whatever. What if we could turn that love of rubbing up against things into its own language? So I want you to just know from the outset that Thig is one of the languages that rats speak. The other one, I mean, it comes out in what I'm going to be reading, but the other one is Spanglish, or I should say more like English. You know what? It'll make sense when I read it. You'll actually get this part. So this reading has two epigraphs at the front, and one is from Miss Frisbee and the Rats of Nim. It goes, "When you've lived in a cage, you can't bear not to run, even if what you're running toward is an illusion." And the second epigraph is from the unstoppable Ursula Le Guin. "People who deny the existence of dragons are often eaten by dragons from within." All right, folks, this is Thig. It's broken into parts, but each part has several subsections and they all have different titles to them. So part one is what we're going to be hearing from today, but there are going to be several subtitles. The first subtitle is "Fear is the Food of Heroes." "With a rat tucked into each armpit, Consuelo Matanunca ran as fast as he could toward Times Square. He had to, Only he knew about the dragon that was racing through the New York City subway system. Only he knew that it was heading straight for the Neil Simon Theater and that it was going to eat the entire cast of the hit Broadway musical Cats. Don't say it. No, not even the cast of Cats deserves to be devoured by dragons. For shame. Look, his beloved Tia Alegría was one of the actors in the show, and no way was he going to allow her to be eaten. That dragon had already swallowed too many members of his family that night. Now, you might think a 10-year-old running at night on a Manhattan sidewalk might attract some attention from folks. Furthermore, Consuelo was wearing a black, spongy, sewer-proof hazmat bodysuit. It squished sewer juice onto the sidewalk with every stride. The only part of his bodysuit that wasn't black and spongy and sewagey was his faceplate. But that thing was impenetrable one-way glass. When you look at someone's face and get a mirror instead, it's a little disturbing, right? And don't forget, he had two darling rats in his armpits. Some humans would find that the most disturbing thing of all. So, maybe you'd expect people to be screaming and pointing at him and jumping out of the way. Maybe you'd expect someone to call the cops. But nah. This is NYC, baby! New Yorkers are the world's greatest masters of mind your beeswax. Consuelo ran through the crowd at top speed in his unusual attire, but the crowd didn't even part to make way for him. In the way of New Yorkers, everyone just kind of schmooved around each other, not making eye contact, not saying excuse me. Those New Yorkers that schmooved around Consuelo smelled a lot more sewery than they had just a second ago, but none of their noses even twitched. New Yorkers are way, way, way too cool to let their noses twitch. It's like they all went to the same runway model school or something. Consuelo, right now, was the opposite of a runway model. He couldn't care less how he looked. All he cared about was defeating the dragon, saving his Tia, and then searching for the rest of his family. He was breathing hard and sweating harder. He looked at the world with hard eyes, and he squeezed his hands into fists, pumping them hard as he ran. But it was his jackhammer heart that worked hardest of all, and not just because he was getting the cardio workout of a lifetime. His thig was full of fear. To fight that fear, Consuelo said, out loud, "Today, I will slay a dragon. Heroes slay dragons. And if I am afraid, so what? Fear is the food of heroes." We love the way Consuelo talks. He is the sincerest human we have ever known. When you look up the word irony in the dictionary, there's a picture of Consuelo, and the caption beneath it reads, "The opposite of this kid." The point is, those words gave Consuelo the motivation to speed up, which seemed impossible. He was already booking it so hard, but now he was booking even bookier. Nothing on Broadway was moving as fast as he was. Not people, not animals, not even cars. But then again, this is New York. Cars get passed by fire hydrants here. "Time," Consuelo said, between breaths. His sewer-proof hazmat bodysuit's AI/personal assistant replied, "24 p.m. The AI's name was Boca Grande, which is a very good name for a very bossy AI. "There is a four-minute slowdown ahead caused by clueless tourists and slack-jawed gawkers. You are still on the fastest route." "Faster," Consuelo said, out loud. Encouragement, a promise, and an unbreakable vow all rolled into one. It was so earnest and powerful a statement, it thigged through his entire body like an electric tidal wave. The rats in his pits shook like struck bells, and their little cutie patootie rat brains shorted out for 6 full human heartbeats. New section. Eugenia lives. Consuelo had started running as soon as he had finished his first battle with the dragon. He had popped out of the old City Hall subway stop at 8:13 p.m. That's near the bottom of Manhattan. And now he was just passing 21st Street at 8:24 p.m. That meant he was running about a 5.5 minute mile. For a young human, that is fast. But by rat standards, Consuelo Matanunca was a god. He had been running for 11 minutes straight. Any rat that tried that would pop like a fat rat firecracker in under 30 seconds. And still, all Consuelo wanted, we knew we could thig it, was to go faster. This is why we love him, by the way. Why we love the whole thigging Matanunca family. They're champions. Every one of them. And friends to all rat kind. The least we could do was to help the Matanuncas in their hour of need. That is why we had sent two of our representatives, the rats in Consuelo's armpits, to help. Those two rats reminded Consuelo constantly, with all the electric earnestness with which a rat can thig, that there was still hope. Eugenia, said the rat in his left armpit out loud in Spanish. That rat was named Rabioso. Lives, said the rat in his right armpit out loud in English. Her name was La Plaga. They would have said more encouraging words, except that they couldn't. Literally, the only word in human Rabioso knew how to say was Eugenia. He was that word's voice. The rat who had been entrusted to speak Eugenia's name whenever we needed to speak human out loud. La Plaga was the voice of the word live, but she was so smart. She could say live with a short I and live with a long I. And she could say living and lived and lives. Amazing. Oh, but even geniuses have their limits. One time, when La Plaga tried to say enliven, she weed herself and fell into a coma for 3 days. And she definitely couldn't say will live, because will is a whole different word. And Mocovede was the only rat in New York City who could say the word will out loud. And he wasn't there, because Consuelo didn't have three armpits. But what our human vocabularies lacked in breadth, they make up for in passion. Rabioso and La Plaga repeated over and over with the unstoppable power of an old-timey train, Eugenia lives, Eugenia lives, Eugenia lives! And while they said those words out loud, they figged encouragement and admiration with their whole bodies shaking like joy buzzers in Consuelo's pits. Humans often find having wiggling rats in their armpits somewhat ticklish, but Consuelo was focused like a Spartan on his mission. And everyone knows Spartans are not ticklish. New section. Schnauzers do not like the taste of sewers. Now you know. Consuelo found hauling his human hiney north on Broadway on this fine summer Saturday night extremely difficult. As we said, the streets were packed with people. In Manhattan, they always are. Why? Because apartments in New York City are small. How small? We're so glad you asked. You can stand in your kitchen and change a light bulb in your bedroom. They have to install the bathtubs vertically. Always, since time immemorial, used any excuse in the world to go outside. Ooh, sorry, I'm just going to make sure my camera's okay here. Smacking things around here. All right. But now, good people, once COVID had been well and truly defeated, this is science fiction, it's set in the future, may that day come soon. But once COVID had been well and truly defeated, nothing could convince a Manhattanite to stay indoors. They absolutely thronged the streets and parks and open spaces of New York, making every street corner a clot of human bodies, every park a human popcorn popper of activity, every sidewalk a sudden parade, a jubilant cavalcade, celebrating nothing more than the ability to cavalcade jubilantly. Restaurant tables overflowed onto the sidewalks. Cars could hardly move. There were so many people always crossing in the crosswalks. Dogs on leashes tried to smell every one of the hundreds and hundreds of butts that whizzed by them. At this point in human history, the dogs of Manhattan were the happiest dogs in the whole world. So many butts. So many butts. Well, someone loved dogs, but right now, dogs were his enemies because, you see, when certain dogs see someone running, they go into chase mode. Like, say, the miniature Schnauzer Consuelo passed on the corner of Broadway and 25th at 8:27 p.m. The elderly man walking it didn't have it on a leash because, well, there was no good reason. Humans, like rats, can be jerks. Leash your dogs, jerks! And so, its bark, a song of murder. The Schnauzer charged Consuelo and bit him on his right ankle. Poor dog. Poor, poor pupper. When it sank its fangs into the sewer-proof hazmat bodysuit, it instantly learned several pieces of very bad news. One, the sewer-proof hazmat bodysuit was basically the unholy child of Black Marshmallows and the Michelin Man. Its bite had no effect. Its teeth just sank into the black marshmallowy, Michelin-manly softness of the suit and were trapped there, like dinosaurs drowning in a tar pit. Two, the sewer-proof hazmat bodysuit did not taste like marshmallows or anything you would find at a Michelin star restaurant. It tasted like a sewer. Three, Schnauzers do not like the taste of sewer. This last fact surprised us. Dogs eat trash all the time. They drink from toilets. And may the rat god bless you if you've had to keep your dog from treating your cat's litter box as an all-you-can-eat buffet. We rats may live in sewers, but friends, we have standards. Before today, we would have said dogs have no standards. But, apparently, Schnauzers draw the line at sewer-proof hazmat bodysuits that have been marinated in sewer juice and bruleed by the summer heat until they taste like sponge cake recovered from a porta-potty. Ah, sad little Schnauzer. Bit off a little more than you could chew, did you? Consuelo was so focused on running that he hadn't even noticed that a small dog had bitten his right ankle, could not let go, and was presently learning the meaning of the word regret. The Schnauzer could have kept biting him for 100 years and Consuelo would not have felt a thing. So protective is the sewer-proof hazmat bodysuit. Those things are designed to protect against sewer alligator bites, people. No, Consuelo only noticed the hapless half-hound when it whined. New section. You do not have to put rats in your armpits in order to speak fig. I mean, you can if you want to, and the rats will certainly enjoy it, but it's not strictly required. Rabioso and La Plaga didn't need to be touching Consuelo's skin when he was wearing a sewer-proof hazmat bodysuit in order to thig with him. It was specifically designed to allow humans and rats to thig with each other without coming into bodily contact. Thig is a language without sound. It transmits meaning by touch, sensation, feeling. But since humans don't generally like to have a lot of exposed flesh when they're down in the sewers, the Matanuncas designed a protective suit, patent pending, that provided both one, unmatched bodily protection, and two, thigmiotic somatic sensation. Or, to put it simply, tickle Consuelo when he's wearing his sewer-proof hazmat bodysuit, and he will laugh, but prick him, and he will not bleed. Yes, rats read Shakespeare. Now you know. Manhattan is noisy, so Consuelo didn't hear the dog who was ankle-biting him whimper, so much as he felt sorrow and remorse, and, oh no, what is this terrible taste in my mouth? Digging up his leg and spreading all the way up to the thinking parts of his body, namely his stomach and his brain. Consuelo stopped running on the corner of Broadway and 29th. What was that? There's a schnauzer attached to your ankle, said Boca Grande in its snottiest robot voice. Why didn't you tell me? Because, sniffed Boca Grande, even though it was an AI and had no nose. It posed no threat to us. It was too small and light to slow us down, and frankly, it needed to learn a lesson about not biting people's ankles. Please, Boca Grande, stop trying to teach everyone harsh lessons all the time. But teaching harsh lessons is my love language, said Boca Grande. But it knew it was one busted AI and went quiet. Consuelo knelt and twisted around so he could see the dog. "You poor thing," he said, and his empathy washed through Rabioso and La Plaga like mercy from heaven. "Will you let me help you let go?" Consuelo put his fingers on the doggo's jaws. The dog growled, but it wasn't a threatening growl. The thig that went along with the growl was a complex emotion. It meant something like, "Sorry, human, but my idiot canine instincts are forcing me to growl right now, even though there's nothing more in the world I would rather do than remove my mouth from your disgusting ankle and run away as fast as I can. Please help me. Oh, and apologies in advance if I nip you while you are trying to help again. Idiot canine instincts. Sincerely, one thoroughly rueful doge." "I understand," said Consuelo. We could fig the growing gentleness swelling inside of him, even before the dog could. Consuelo was preparing to release a great deal of fig in one massive rush of communication. He let go of the dog's jaws and pressed the pup's midsection with both hands. Then, like a thousand doves being released at a wedding, Consuelo figged, "I love you," to the schnauzer. Rabioso and La Plaga felt like they died and went to heaven, which, by the way, is exactly what it feels like to spend all night in a dumpster in Little Italy. They were too figged out to remember anything else from that moment. They just lay curled in Consuelo's armpits and twitched happily and squeaked blissfully. But the rats, who were on the scene at 29th and Broadway, peering from garbage cans and sewer grates, reported that the schnauzer immediately removed its mouth from Consuelo's ankle and began politely coughing. It never took its eyes off of Consuelo after that moment, but not because it was scared. No, quite the opposite. The schnauzer was schmitten. It had never felt a rush of love as complete as what Consuelo had just given it. After that moment, that schnauzer would have followed Consuelo anywhere. It would do anything for him. Even after Consuelo let the pupper go, it shot invisible heart-tipped arrows at Consuelo with its eyes. That's the power of fig, people. That dog would love Consuelo for the rest of its life. And I think I will stop there. Thank you very much, everybody. So grateful for you. Thank you.
Speeches and Regalia by Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. Here on listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and online at WBAI.org. And please do not forget to call and contribute to the Tower Fund to pay for where we broadcast from, the rental for that space. We're 2 months behind, and we want to get ahead in the 2022 finances. This is something we can never fall behind on again. And being listener-sponsored radio, we depend on you to help us out. And the way that you do that is by dialing area code 212-209-2950. Again, 212-209-2950. Or set up your web browser and aim it at the heart of the sun, at WBAI.org or at towerfund.WBAI.org. I find just going to WBAI.org to be the simplest thing, and gives you, well, more information about the station in general, and it's another way that we communicate with you. Okay, as I started playing Carlos Hernandez's wonderful reading, and if we were live, I'd be, you know, going up and saying, wasn't that wonderful? Thank you. Although it was Amy Goldschlager was the host of this particular show that we're halfway through. I got a text. I didn't even realize it was barely in my consciousness that the Hugo Awards, which is an award given out by science fiction fandom, you join Worldcon, which is held in a different location each year. I opted not to go because I am avoiding crowds of people until we know exactly where this pandemic is coming from, where it's going, who's got it, who hasn't. It's all very complicated. It's one of the reasons why we are not yet prepared to, assuming that we find our venue, we're not going live. We're going to be continuing online. But the awards were given out. They were, I mentioned earlier, Cherie Renee Thomas was co-host of the ceremony, along with another friend of ours, a great writer, Andrea Hairston. And I'm not going to get into all of the nominees, although so many of them are friends. Hell, one of them lives half a mile from here, N.K. Jemison, Nora Jemison. But I will tell you the winners, and maybe next week on our Christmas show, Solstice show, we should say, even Solstice was passed. Suffice it to say, I am not a person who celebrates Christmas itself. I do not believe it to be a generic holiday. I believe it to be a very specific religious holiday, and ain't my religion. But we have a great tradition of a particular short story that is Christmas-related, called The Star by Arthur C. Clarke. And I am looking around trying to find Baird Searles' wonderful reading of that. Failing that, you may have to live with me reading it. But that's not that long a story. That's like half an hour. And maybe we can discuss the Hugo nominations and winners on the phone after that. But I will tell you the winners now. Let us not keep you in suspense. So, for best novel, the aforementioned Martha Wells, who was on this program in the last year, Network Effect, which is the fifth book in her Murderbot series. For best novella, this is a person I do not know, and I am really ashamed that I am going to murder their name. So I will spell it first and then give it a try. The name of the novella is The Empress of Salt and Fortune, published by Tor.com. And the author is Inghi Vo. N-G-H-I is the first name. Vo, the latter name. And I'm ashamed to say I know I just botched it, but by next week I will unbotch it for us all. Novelette. That's shorter than a novella, longer than a short story. A novelette. The winner was Two Truths and a Lie by our good friend Sarah Pinsker, who I understand did not attend Worldcon because she tested positive just before going. At least that's what I heard. But a lot of fine people were nominated for that. Again, we'll discuss it next week. Best Short Story. T. Kingfisher from Uncanny Magazine for the story Metal Like Blood in the Dark. And let's see how many friends. Yunha Lee. Actually, it was the only other person in that category who I know. Best Series. This is relatively new category. And redundant to the winner for Best Novel, Martha Wells for The Murderbot Diaries. And Best Related Work. Related work to science fiction and fantasy means it's not of the field itself, it's about it. And Maria Davana Headley won for Beowulf, A New Translation. And there's at least one thing in there that I can't even say on the air the title of. Best Graphic Story or Comic is Parable of the Sower, a graphic novel adaptation based on the novel by Octavia Butler. I haven't seen the graphic version, so I cannot comment. Best Dramatic Presentation, Long Form, in other words, a movie, something that is 2 hours long. The Old Guard, written by Greg Rucka. I saw that on Netflix. I thought it was actually rather good. Personally, I would vote it for Soul, written by Pete Docter for Pixar. True form. Okay. Short form best dramatic presentation. It usually means an episode of something, of a show. And it was the final episode of the series The Good Place, Whenever You're Ready, written and directed by Michael Schur. Again, I would have probably voted. I don't love all of the nominees. I would have probably voted for Doctor Who, Fugitive of the Jadoon. That was a particularly good episode. Best Editor, Short Form, Ellen Datlow. Yay. Best Editor, Long Form, Diana Foe. That's P-H-O, who I think she's full-time at Tor Books. I don't think she's a freelancer. Best Artist, Ravina Kai, C-A-I. Best Semi-Prozine, Faya Magazine of Black Speculative Fiction. A fine, fine, fine magazine. Best Fanzine, Nerds of a Feather Flock Together. Best Fan Cast, for several years in a row, and deservedly so, the Cood Street Podcast, that's C-O-O-D-E, which is done by Jonathan Strahm, who's out of Australia, I think. It's either Australia or New Zealand. And Gary K. Wolf, who I believe is out of Chicago. And there's more. Best Fan Writer, Best Fan Artist, Best Video Games called Hades, Best Young Adult Book is now the Lodestar Award. It had a different name earlier, and I'm not remembering what it is. A Wizard's Guide to Defensive Baking by T. Kingfisher. The Astounding Award for Best New Writer went to Emily Tesh. That used to be called the John W. Campbell Award, but it has come to pass in any number of things, from ornithology to awards and all that, to depersonalize, take away people's names and replace them more with associated topics, because it often turns out that as we progress in our sophistication of knowledge about various people, who they are and what they do, that they may have done something that 100 years ago or 50 years ago was considered not good, but run of the mill for society at the time, and since then has transgressed. I mean, a good example, the Audubon Society in birding. James Audubon was a brilliant, wonderful artist, and did a lot to open the world of birding to people. But he also was a slave trader and a slaveholder. And he's also, get this, for a person who is responsible for making people aware of different breeds of birds and stuff like that, and his beautiful, beautiful drawings, maybe one of the people most responsible for the extinction of the passenger pigeon, because he used to bring people out with shotguns, and the skies were described as being almost dark because there were that many passenger pigeons. And so he took people out and started shooting and shooting and shooting. And, well, they're extinct. So the Audubon Society is now wrestling with what are they going to call themselves in the future? They have lost their enthusiasm for their name. And such a thing has also occurred with a number of the awards in the science fiction realm. H.P. Lovecraft, who we always knew was a creepy, and I don't mean like in the sense of horror, he was just a creepy individual. So people are saying, you know, why are we giving this guy naming an award after this guy? It's a slightly complicated issue, because the award was not very kind to him. It was designed by Gayon Wilson, the cartoonist, and really wasn't complimentary to his looks. There was a certain amount of tongue-in-cheek, but there are a lot of people who felt we should not be celebrating this guy, positive or negative. Let's just, you know, I'm not going to say cancel him, but let's bury him. I have, mixed feelings about the whole thing. Probably a topic for another show. But there you have it. So let's see. I think I covered the awards I wanted to. Dramatic presentation, short form, editors, artists. Yes. Yes, I have. And I'll go into more detail. I don't think I'm going to go into certain categories. It is, after all, Fanish Award. If you want the professional awards, the ones that are given out by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, check out the Nebula Awards. But a very good way to find out, gee, you know, I don't read the science fiction stuff that you talk about on the air, Jim, but I like the things that I hear you play. Where do I get more of it? I usually suggest get, you know, the best science fiction of the year anthologies, get the best, the Nebula Award winners, and get the Hugo Award winners. Well, these were the Hugos as presented yesterday. So, I think we are going to hear a review from Dan Persons now, entitled The Feast. I actually have two, because I prepared one for last week, but did not get to play it. And that was of the new version of the TV series. Of course, the name has just flown out of my head, even though I'm in the middle of watching the show. But it's based on an anime show. I was never a fan of anime. But Cowboy Bebop. And the live series is what Dan reviewed. And in between his reviewing it and now, show's been canceled. Well, what I think we're going to do is have Dan on the phone in a couple of weeks, and we're going to discuss that and other media science fiction. What did we have in the year 2021? What might we be looking forward to or dreading next year? So, he has, however, turned in a review for this week, as I stall for time, finding out where did I hide that? Yeah, probably. There it is. And this is something entitled The Feast. Whoops, except Zappa was still playing. I don't like that music player that I have doesn't stop playing when the song is over. It just automatically segues to whatever it likes next. Okay, so reintroducing Dan's review. Assuming I can find where I hit it now. Here it is. The Feast.
And this is my Hour of the Wolf review. I'm going to get this out of the way right off the top and say that I had problems with the ending of The Feast, the new Welsh horror film about a dinner party that goes horribly wrong, that might still be in theaters, once again, Omicron, but is definitely available for rental through streaming services. This is the kind of film that's meant to be a slow build to a dizzying, gut-wrenching ending, and unfortunately, director Lee Haven Jones, who, among other works, has a handful of recent Doctor Who episodes to his name, doesn't quite nail it, tossing out awkward visual metaphors and bursts of machine gun rapid editing in a way that's supposed to overwhelm, but just winds up kind of off-putting. That said, there are moments within the finale that are striking in a grim, caustic way, such as one guest's devolution into a gluttonous animal. And right up until Jones has to bring it home, I was riveted overall. If somebody hasn't done a study of the use of a dinner gathering as a narrative gambit, how so static a setting can be used to quite dynamic purposes, they should. Here, the dinner forms a relatively small component of the story, which focuses on a prominent family of four, a mother, two sons, and the father, who's a member of parliament, prepping for a dinner party in their country getaway, which was once the mother's home, until the farmhouse was razed and replaced with a kind of glassed-in, modern architecture box that comes complete with its own cell-like meditation room. They bring in a local woman to serve, Katie, played by Anis Elwy, and I'm probably getting the Welsh pronunciation wrong there, sorry. And you will not be surprised to discover that the mysteriously stoic servant might have an agenda beyond just dishing out the salad. Writer Roger Williams frames a lot of deliciously grotesque details into his script. One son, played by Sean Allen Davies, is the kind of proto-Aryan fitness nut who's not abashed about wolfing down raw meat cut into annoyingly precise cubes in front of the assembled diners. The other son, played by Stefan Chenid, again, sorry for the pronunciation, is a sullen club-goer who doesn't think twice about gorging on the magic mushrooms Katie tracks down for him. The jerk. The parents, father played by Julian Lewis Jones, mother by Nia Roberts, are the kinds of entitled upper class who think their stark little country getaway somehow returns them to their roots, even while staging a dinner for the express purpose of convincing their neighbors to strike a business deal that will bring developers onto land that, local myth has it, is cursed. So yeah, the feast does stumble at the end, and pretty dramatically in my estimation. But that didn't seriously undercut my enjoyment of the film. There's too much wicked social satire and nuanced strangeness to dismiss it out of hand. In a genre still overstuffed with slashers and leveragings of internet trends, it paves its own deliciously outrageous way. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
And my favorite feast movies are probably two by Louis Buñuel, although nobody ever actually gets to eat in them. One of them is The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, and the other one is the Something Angel. Well, you can look it up. Very sadly, Stephen Sondheim was considering an adaptation of both of those films into one musical, but of course it never happened. Although the end of Dan's review there reminded me of the song A Weekend in the Country, so there's a whole lot of Sondheim to go around. And I did a Sondheim show a few weeks ago, and that's not the last of his music that you'll be hearing in this time slot. You're tuned to WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and webcasting, streaming over WBAI.org. And we remind you to support the radio station, specifically the Tower Fund Drive. This is to pay the rent on our transmitter, an issue that has been longstanding with this radio station when, once upon a time, people who don't work for the radio station actually negotiated a usurious contract for us. We've gotten out of that, and now we are in a much better place with a much better rent. But we can't fall behind, and we are a little behind. We're 2 months behind, and we got to take care of the next year. And so we need you to not just call up and support Hour of the Wolf or support the radio station, although you'll be doing all of these things when you call to pledge or go to the website to pledge, but you'll be donating to money that is earmarked to our transmitter room. And, well, you know, we can sit here and talk all day, and maybe we'll be heard on the internet. Maybe not. But we're a radio station, a broadcast radio station. In order to broadcast, we got to pay for that tower. In order to pay for that tower, we need and have a tower fund drive. 212-209-2950 is the number to call to pledge to that tower fund drive, or go to towerfund.wbai.org using your browser. If you go there with pencil and paper, if you have pencil and paper, just write us a check and mail it, okay? But otherwise, the easiest thing to do is to make a phone call, 212-209-2950. Please don't delay, because we have to do this. We have set a time limit on this particular drive for New Year's. So, not far away. Okay, we're now going to hear part two of the reading that was done by husband and wife team, Carlos Hernandez, who you hopefully already heard the first part of. And after that, was CSE Cooney, Claire Cooney. And she is introduced by our host for this month. Okay, what am I? I'm already playing it, aren't I? Yeah. Good going, Jim. You'd think that once upon a time I knew what I was doing, right? You'd think that. Okay, so, curator emeritus of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, Amy Goldschlager, was our host, and here is Claire Cooney with Amy.
CSE Cooney is the author of the World Fantasy Award-winning Bone Swan Stories. And, you know, the other one that's not even in this list is she did this great pandemic collection that I absolutely loved called The Witch of the Almond Tree and Other Stories. Did I get the title right, Claire? Yeah.
The Witch and the Almond Tree and Other
Stories. Of the Almond Stories, which is also really good. And I advise you all to find out either the text version or the audiobook version, but you should get the audiobook version. In 2022, her novel Saint Death's Daughter debuts with Solaris, as well as her collection Dark Breakers, all stories taking place in the world of Desdemona and the Deep. Her novella, which was published by Tor.com, and the collection is forthcoming from Mythic Delirium, who, as I'm sure you know, has made several appearances at NERSIF. Mike Allen is a wonderful friend of the series. Claire's short novel, The Twice-Drowned Saint, appears in Mythic Delirium's A Sinister Quartet and made the 2020 Locus Recommended Reading List for Best First Novel, which reminds me I really have to put in my votes for this year. That's my problem. Her 2021 short work includes stories in Uncanny Magazine and Mermaids Monthly, both co-written with husband Carlos Hernandez, and both inspired by story prompts from Negocios Infernales, a TTRPG designed by Cooney and Hernandez, forthcoming from Outland Entertainment. And I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that later because it really is awesome. Find her online as csecooney.com, at csecooney on Twitter and IG, and facebook.com/cscooney. Claire Cooney.
Hi. Thank you so much for watching tonight and tuning in. I guess I have a couple things because I do have two books coming out next year. I did selections from both of them. They'll run just a couple minutes over 25 minutes. And I there had been some mention of perhaps singing. I did find in my files my Krampus Santa Baby parody called Krampus Baby, but maybe we'll save that for later if there's time. They'd asked for music and I was like, well, that's what I have. I didn't really rehearse it, but I think it's funny anyway. I think I'll start with Dark Breakers. The only thing that I have time to read in its entirety is the last short story in Dark Breakers, because mostly Dark Breakers is big novellas and novelettes collected all together. The first two novellas, The Breaker Queen and The Two Paupers, are about the length of Desdemona and the Deep. So they're basically almost novels, but not quite. And then I wrote a new novella and a new novelette. But the only short story in this collection is called Sisera to the Moon. I guess what you have to know is this. There are three worlds in one. And there's the world of the goblins, which is the Bone Kingdom, Bana the Bone Kingdom. Then there's the world of the gentry, which are like fairies. And that's called sometimes the Valwode or the Veil Between Worlds. And then there's the human world, Aeth, which kind of sounds like Earth. So when they talk about Aeth, they're talking about human things, things that we would know. And it, like the Bond of the Bone Kingdom, the goblins always exist in a perpetual night. And in the Valwode with the gentry are, it's always twilight. And the humans just have normal like cycles because they're the top world. And then there's the world beneath. Then there's the world beneath the world beneath. And I guess that you just kind of have to have that kind of in your bones to intuit this story the best. Sisera to the Moon. Here's the illustration for it. It's very pretty. This collection is going to be published in February of next year. So just a couple months. And you can pre-order it on mythicdelirium.com. Chaz, said Sisera, the night hag, queen of the Valwode, 12th daughter of Errol Lord Kalos Gonsaros, king of kobolds and all the goblin kin, to her darling wife as they lay in bed one night. Correction, it was not night. It was evening. In the Valwood, it was always evening and never night. But even without a proper night, or morning for that matter, a bed was still a beautiful thing, an awfully convenient location at any hour of the gloaming, if the Valwood had hours, or indeed any measurement of time, which it didn't. In a bed, one could lounge about, or loll around, or read, or make love to all one's lovers, or eat fat black grapes off of one's wife's bejeweled belly, and then, best of all, fall asleep upon her breast, and dream and dream and dream the Valwood into being. Sisera was very fond of both her bed and her wife, but there was one dream that she, greatest of dreamers, the visionary of the veil between worlds, could not make manifest in her own home, which was, in a word, preposterous. It could not stand. "Chaz," Sisera said again, more insistently. Absently turning a page of her magazine, Chaz replied, "Yes, love." Alas, that their third spouse, Albin Idris, was off on a quest of its own, somewhere upworld on Aeth, leaving its two wives to their own devices. At Darkbreakers, Albin's infrequent truancies always made Chaz somewhat vague and inattentive, made Sisera restless and itchy. Albin was their anchor, their safe harbor, their gentling influence. Without its presence, Sisera tended to start climbing walls and hanging from ceilings, literally, and Chaz took to lying about and listlessly thumbing through her latest stack of art magazines. Sisera wrinkled her nose at the current magazine. To her exquisitely sensitive goblin girl nostrils, it smelled too much like humans, the stale, sticky, toilety parts of humans. The Valwo didn't do toilets, but Sisera had seen one once, the big public toilet of Laressa Central Station up on Aeth. She recalled a vast, cave-like building where steel-stinking trains were constantly roaring in and out of an underground network like great rail-bound worms, only not as fabulous as worms, but with cushier seats and windows for staring out of onto the weird landscape of Aeth. Sisera had been to that station only once, for nefarious purposes that she will not admit to, even in the third person. And while she had enjoyed her train ride more than she cared to admit, she did not like the stenchful toilets. Being a goblin girl, with a goblin girl's anatomy, Sisera had no need for commodes. Chaz, when Chaz was human, might have used a few, but Chaz was no longer human. Chaz, like Sisera, was gentry queen of the Valwood, the veil between worlds, a gentry queen, or whatever. So like she'd said already, the Valwood didn't do toilets. It did, however, do fumets. Fumets existed for highly entertaining activities, like the wild hunt. You can't hunt unicorns or dragons or glatisants or any of that without glittering scat to follow. Everybody knew that. Chaz, pay attention to me. Stop making out with the... Sisera's eyes crossed, trying to read the magazine upside down. The Seafall aesthetic, like it is more gorgeous than I am. We both know that that is a lie. Am I not your beloved? Am I not your oath-sworn wife? Am I not your queen? She put on her darkest, most resoundifying goblin-y voice for that last bit. Here, Queen Chaz, the Incarnadined, put the magazine down, but not all the way down, and smiled over the top edge. You are my goddess. How may I serve you? Seeing the tender glow light Chaz's round blue eyes, Sisera melted into an Icarus puddle of goblin goo. Her hair legs got all somnolent and sexy. She blinked a slow cat blink, and manifested in place of Chaz's current sartorial attire, a revealing nightgown of scarlet and gold with some very interesting mesh bits and slits. Oh? Chaz glanced down at her newly garbed self. Now the magazine went all the way away, beyond the pillow even, to Sasira's eminent satisfaction. She couldn't wish mortal things away, like that hell-spawned magazine, alas. Chaz had to actually, you know, put them down. Is this what you're after, Sasira? She gestured to her delectable self. No, Sasira said, pleased at her success. Or, well, yes, but not just yet. I want you, Chaz. She climbed atop her wife and sat upon her ribcage cross-legged. To tell me all about... She bent to bring her dwayberry dark lips right up close to Chaz's scarlet scimitar smile. The moon! Chaz's head scrunched down into the pillow. I beg your pardon? I want to know all about the moon! Sasira shouted, sitting upright and bouncing a little. Chaz didn't even oof. Sasira weighed practically nothing. Goblin girls were made of cobwebs and chitin and a kind of creepy-crawly sensation. And Chaz was a fine, strapping woman, very healthy, with flesh and blood and all that sort of thing. Sort of. That was how she dreamed herself, anyway. Chaz used to be mortal, the way Albin Idris used to be a clay statue, the way she, Sasira, used to be a full-blown, full-time goblin, no question. But now they were all three of them gentry, transformed from whatever they used to be, that they might co-rule the Volwode together and dream it into being. Sometimes Sasira forgot this and acted too goblin-y for her people's liking. Sometimes Albin Idris stood too still, mesmerizing whatever gentry happened to glance in its direction. And sometimes Chaz read stupid human magazines instead of paying attention to her beautiful wife. Mostly they all balanced each other nicely, which was why there were three of them reigning over the Volwode and its gentry denizens instead of just Sasira lording over all, which had been admittedly a childhood ambition of hers. It was an ambition that she'd once in her youngishness fomented a marvelous rebellion in order to achieve. Well, that had failed. And she'd got clapped in iron for it. Blah. And she'd learned her lesson. And then she met Chazzy, and here they all were. Ah, youth. Enough twilight had passed since they were first seated with the scion horn of the antler crown and took the throne together that Chaz didn't even smell mortal anymore. Praise the horns. That had happened, what was it now, 60 years or so ago, as mortals reckoned time? Chaz and Albin Idris were better at calculating stupid things like time. Sasira really couldn't care less, except that they both did. Only Chaz's antler crown still retained a whiff of mortality, with its tines of red iron stained with the last drops of her heart's blood as they had pierced their way out of her skull. But Chaz was not mortal. Not anymore. She was entirely gentry, just like Sasira liked it. Chaz would last longer that way. She'd last forever, if Sasira had any say about it. Which she did. Sasira was still waiting for Chaz to answer her question. Chaz was taking so long. Chaz was a darling, but she did mull. Sasira considered grasping Chaz's antler crown in both her fists and shaking it a little, making Chaz jiggle all over in all the right ways. But no, Chaz was opening her mouth. She was talking. I can tell you about the moon if you really want me to, Sasa, but you aren't going to find it very interesting. Why not? Sasira demanded with instant umbrage. All right. So perhaps she had forgotten, just for a moment, what it was exactly she had asked Chaz in the first place. Who could blame her when Chaz had taken so totally and entirely too long, ages, eons, to answer? But now that Sasira remembered, you bet she found it interesting. Very. What makes you think I won't like it? I think I will love it. It is the moon. We don't have one in the Volwode. The one time I tried to dream one up, a three-petaled flower bloomed in the sky. One petal silver, one petal white, one petal black. And now it will not go away, which is most vexatious. I have never even seen the moon for myself. That one time when the three of us snuck up into 8th, Chazzy, and we went on that adventuresome train ride, I looked for the moon through the window all night long, but there wasn't one to be had for love or dreaming because you said it was the wrong time of the month or the wrong side of the world or something, and I just couldn't wish a moon into the sky when there was none to be had. Not that you listened to me, Chaz muttered. You tried anyway. Sasira snorted. Of course I didn't listen. But my powers didn't work so well on 8th that time. She tucked her pointy chin and grumbled. I bet Nyx the Nightwalker could have made the moon bloom. Here in the Valwod or up on 8th, whatever the time of month. She was a gentry queen of dread repute. Fell and perilous and totally swole and... And thousands of years old, love, Chaz put in. You are just a spiderling yet. You have time to grow stronger. But Chaz, I want the moon now. I want to bring it here to the Valwod. Don't you think we ought to have a moon? Moons are for mortals, Chaz said firmly. Mortals have such little lives. They get to have the night sky and all its objects. It's their only infinity. It's not fair. Is it not enough, Sasa? Chaz interrupted her. To be the moon? You who shine so brightly, all the Valwod is lit by you. You who make the tides crash and the crickets sing. The Valwod doesn't have any crickets. All right, pixies then. You make the pixies sing. They'd better, Sasira said darkly. Chaz laughed from way down below on the bed. Sasira glanced around in surprise. In her dudgeon, she'd somehow managed to somersault herself into the air and attach herself to the ceiling by the hair legs. Now she loosed herself and drifted back down to the bed like a bit of gossamer on a breeze to curl up close to her wife again. Chaz made room for her by knocking the rest of the magazines to the floor. Sasira purred in contentment, but not for long. Why? She asked plaintively, popping back up. Why, Chazzy, why can't I make the moon? Because, Chaz sighed, the moon is an ontological reality, not a phenomenological construct. It cannot therefore exist in the Valwod, where our world's very existence depends on which way we dream it. Sasira waited. It's just a big dusty rock, Sasa, a ball of pitted asphalt. No atmosphere, moonquakes, cold lava and ice. A human can't live up there. I mean, other than the fact that it's hundreds of thousands of miles away, with no easy way to get there, and no air to breathe, there's something else called space radiation, which kills you slowly if everything else doesn't do you in first. It's just not gentry, Sasira. The Valwod doesn't need the moon. We are a world made of moonlight. Sasira stroked her wife's spine gently. The poisoned tips of her talons tickled, but did not prick. You need it, she said softly. Chaz groaned and buried her face in her arms. You need the moon, Sasira accused her, cheerfully, viciously, triumphantly. You miss it. You pine for it. You can't hide something like that from me. Not for more than half a century, as you former mortal types reckon time, anyway. I will always be able to tell these things by and by. Mark me. Chaz made a noise like, that Sasira interpreted correctly as, yes, my queen, my goddess, you know me so well. How did I ever live all the whole mortal sum of my years without your wiliness, your rapier insight, your beauty, and your unbearable perspicacity? That does it, Sasira clapped her hands together. Say no more, my Chazzy. I know what I'm going to get you and Alban Idris for our next anniversary gift. I am going to give you the moon. Sasira! Chaz bellowed, aggravated, her antler crown casting red thorn shadows across the glowing walls. You can't just pluck. It's not like it's a mortal thing, okay? You know what? Fine. You're right. I miss the moon. Yes, of course I do, but I'll get over it. I have thousands of years to get over it. You don't have to get over it, Sasira said, reasonably. Alban Idris had taught her how to sound reasonable. Alban Idris always sounded reasonable. It was its best trick. We can go up to 8th and visit the moon right now. Then I will figure out how to call it down for you or get you up there to visit it instead. After all, what is space radiation and the vacuous void to the gentry queens? She demanded at her grandest. Now, advise me, my wife. To whom do I speak about this? Who are the human people in charge of the moon? Chaz, playing along, pretended to think a moment. Well, the AEC, I suppose. The AEC, the Aerospace Exploration Cooperative. It's an international collaboration between the humans, different countries, space agencies. Cecilia's hair legs rose up and rubbed against each other like mating snakes. Hairy ones. Oh, Chazzy, Chazzy, my Chaz, my most Chazmerific of Chazzes, witness me. This AEC of yours is about to get some interworldly collaboration from the Volwod. But Chaz was still not taking her seriously. The poor, benighted, moon-besotted, once-mortal darling. Sessa, really, are you just going to stroll upworld, march into the AEC's Mission Control Center with your robe of cobwebs and your semi-sentient hair legs and your big black antler crown and all, and demand gentry representation on board their next rocket ship? Cecilia shrugged. Sure. Maybe. Yes. Or maybe. And her black purple eyes glinted. I'll just steal you a rocket ship. Then we can go up there together, you and me and Alban Idris. Am I not a perfect genius, the cleverest and slyest and subtlest sovereign of this, our great triumvirate? Would we not all love a short vacation on the moon? It's practically a business trip. It will give us a great lot of new things to dream on, all for the sake of the Volwod. Chaz said, extremely fondly. You know what you are, Cecilia. You're a dreamboat. I am the dreamer of the Volwod, Cecilia said, majestically. And, she promised, I'm going to dream us up a boat to the moon. And that's Cecilia to the moon. And I actually feel that was probably quite enough reading. So I will not read from St. Death's Daughter today because I don't think we have time. But you should pre-order it anyway and trust me that it's fabulous.
And to do that, go to Mythic Delirium Press, where also Bone Swans by C.S.E. Cooney, C-O-O-N-E-Y, can be found. C.S.E. is spelled C-S-E. Otherwise said as Claire. But stay with us.
I once loved a sailor. Once a sailor. Was not a sailor who sailed on the wide blue sea. He sailed in an airship, sailed like a bird on the wing. And every evening at midnight, he would come to my window and say, come take a trip in.
Come take a trip in my airship. Come sail away to
I so love that song. There are a great many versions of it. I mean, ranging from Billy Murray, who was a top recording artist in 1904, has a recording of it. Johnny Cash, of all people, did it. But Natalie Merchant's version was the first one I heard. And it just gave me, loving feelings in hearing that. So I hope you enjoyed it as well. And before that, of course, C.S.E. Cooney from the New York Review of Science Fiction readings held earlier this month. The next one is allegedly the first Tuesday of the coming year. However, we have not yet booked it because didn't really know which way to turn. Were we going to be live face-to-face? Well, the Omicron virus has pretty much put the kibosh on that. And I'm hearing that there may be issues with the space that we have enjoyed for about the last 5 or 6 years and may have to search for a new physical plant. One way or the other, we're still going to be presenting it to you online. We have some very brief time for phone calls. And if you'd like to call up, and it needs to be germane to what we have broadcast on the program this morning, telephone number here to talk on the air is 212-209-2877. That is the second most important number that you will be hearing this morning. Oh, we only have like 2 or 3 minutes in which to take calls. The most important number is 212-209-2950 so that you can, well, pledge your support to WBAI. And most importantly, to the Tower Fund drive so that we will have a place that will transmit our signal to the greater New York metropolitan area. We have fallen behind on the rent in the past due, I should say, to no fault of our own. We had other people who did not necessarily have best wishes of this particular radio station at heart negotiate a usurious deal with our last home for the transmitter. And it's in a new space now. We are slightly, compared to before, slightly behind in paying that rent. And we want to get a head start on 2022. And the way you can do that is by dialing 212-209-2950 or visit towerfund.wbai.org. And having said that, there's really no more time to take calls because I want to do an outro. I get off the air at 7:55. It is now 7:49. And, of course, you know that we want to play our outro music. Assuming I can find where I have hidden it. And that's silent running. I should mention the intro music, of course. The outro music, I'm sorry, is Sails of Silver by Steel Ice Band. The intro music is the Space Fleet from the soundtrack of the motion picture Silent Running, written by Peter Schickele. So we are going to plan out what the Sundays are going to be like on this program. Okay. There is nothing for me to do but to plug this thing back in. Because I know I saw the directory that had my intro and outro music. And, of course, being no master at Windows 10, I covered it up. But I brought it on a thumb drive, so I'm just going to put that thing back in. And see if we can't play it from there for you. Or there's another way I can do it. I have been playing you the other music this morning. Yes, leave side. There we go. And there it comes. Okay, so I think I'm going to begin my outro and tell you I'll be back next week from 6 to 8 a.m. with The Star by Arthur C. Clarke, as well as a discussion of the Hugos and various awards that have just been given out, and will be upcoming, and what you think is going to be deserving, keep your eyes open for, and very possibly our extended review of Cowboy Bebop with Dan Persons. So, thank you all for listening. My name is Jim Freund. You can find me on Facebook in the Hour of the Wolf group, or just under my own name on YouTube. And you can actually watch the readings that you heard this morning there. See the people actually read for you. So, again, good morning, and stay tuned for Morning Ursae. Take care now.
Walking along.
WBAI is the radio station speaking truth to power, presenting a range of alternative views so you can keep your sanity, like Elvis Costello says as he walks through troubled times. And for WBAI to continue, we must pay rent at 4 Times Square, which houses WBAI's transmitter.
We're 2 months behind on that rent, so it's $34,000. So that's a lot we have to catch up on. So a really good reason to support WBAI right now. So help the one truly listener-sponsored radio station pay for the rent to house our transmitter. Say, yes. This is a donation.
2 months behind, folks.
Yes.
What are you going to do when it's gone? Then you're going to have to listen to pancake recipes by Brian Lehrer. Yeah.
$17,000 a month is what it costs, and we are trying to raise enough funds to pay back rent from 2021 and the rent for 2022. Please go to towerfund.wbai.org, towerfund.wbai.org, and donate to keep listener-sponsored WBAI broadcasting into the future, or call 212-209-2950 and say you want to donate to WBAI's Tower Fund. Thank you.
Sting-a-ling-a-ling, or grave thy victory.
McDonough John and McCourt Maliki are on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, on Sundays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Topics, wit, wisdom, wackery, sausages. Join us, please.
But not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling, or grave thy victory?
Thanks to you.
Thank each and every one of you for coming by.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
Extinction Diaries. While the world is caught up with the COVID-19 virus and decompresses from a contentious U.S. election, things in the Arctic have taken an alarming turn for the worse. A record-breaking ice melt led to a refreeze later than ever before, and worse still, the refreeze is failing to solidify on the Siberian side. Most alarming is that no one seems to be talking about it. So let's start. For decades, the science community has warned us that a runaway melt could be triggered if humans do not stop generating greenhouse gases that are heating Earth up. The data each year showed we were failing and should have triggered a global survival response, for the human race is in the balance. We have to face that. It's way past time we all engage. From each of our dinner tables to the very peak of our national infrastructure, economic, manufacturing, transportation, all aspects of human civilization must be quickly transformed to support our survival and not our extinction. To survive, we must save the polar bear's home. If we save the big white bear, humans have a chance. There is no more time. My name is Rising Moon, and this is a Small World Radio production.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
You're listening to WBAI New York, listener-supported Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM, screaming at WBAI.org. Time now is 8 o'clock. It's a slightly overcast Sunday morning. We're going to fill it with light.
Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. James Irsay with you. It's time for another Morning Irsay Sunday edition. James Irsay here, of course. I want to let you know that after about a 20-minute or so travelogue, a mini travelogue through here and there, we're going to introduce you to a special guest we have. Some weeks ago, I discovered an article on the website of one Henry Sapoznik. Henry is a musicologist, a multi-award-winning musicologist, and he specializes in cantorial music, klezmer music, and he made an incredible discovery involving a black cantor. They called him der Schwarze Hasen. The black cantor is literally what that means. And we're going to have Henry as a guest. And we've got putting together some examples of what is known as chazanut, the art of the cantor, including the black cantor, whose name is Thomas LaRue Jones. There are various versions of his name, let's say. So stay with us for that. That'll start at about 15 or minutes or so. But first, we're going to take, to get you used to going to foreign climes, we're going to have a little mini travelogue for you. And we first travel to old China, land of temples, dumplings, firecrackers, and in our case, attention-getting music. I've told you several times I'm not entirely thrilled with this early Sunday time slot, but by the time I get here, I'm in my comfort zone. Can you tell? and everything is okay. It's not okay when the alarm goes off, but I make sure I have an alarm that will get me out of bed. And the first thing I'm going to play for you is the alarm I have that I hear it and I jump out of bed and I'm immediately dialing 911 after a few seconds of hearing this. Actually, of course, I love it. It's from Chinese opera. It's a 78 from about 1907. I'm not sure if it's Cantonese or Mandarin because I just don't know. You can't know everything, you know. I took it to the Chinese restaurant downstairs. They couldn't read the label, so I take it that all they know is the simplified version of Chinese. I suppose if I found someone from Taiwan, because they still use the old style of Chinese characters, maybe they could tell me what the name of it is and who's singing. But it's what I use to get up in the morning. And you'll hear why. It's, you see in the movie, the vampire movie, what is it called again? Not Nostradamus. I forget what it is. You know the one I mean. The one starring Max Schreck, where he gets up from his coffin, just kind of sits up in it, straight up. That happens to me in the morning when I hear my alarm go off to this Chinese music, except where Max Schreck slowly rises. I jump up, practically snapping my backbone as I get erect in the bed. And, of course, as I said, it's a wonderful piece. I think it may be the tale of the white snake, but I'm not sure. But at any rate, imagine you're dead asleep. And then from about about a foot and a half away from your ear, you hear the following music. Yeah. Music from a Chinese opera recorded in 1907. Now, they didn't allow women to go on stage in Chinese operas until about 1930, in the 1930s. So I don't know if that's a woman singing or a man. It sounds like a woman, but you know how that goes. So I don't know. I wish I could get that label read. Anybody who is from listening, who may be from Taiwan, you may want to give this a try, or speaks Cantonese, may want to give this a try. I'll send you a picture of the label, and maybe you can tell us what it says. You know, I'm sure a snake is involved. A snake and a woman. But